Neuro Pathways, a Cleveland Clinic podcast exploring the latest research discoveries and clinical advances in the fields of neurology, neurosurgery, neurorehab, and psychiatry.
Cerebral amyloid angiopathy is a cerebrovascular disorder characterized by the buildup of amyloid proteins in small-sized vessel walls of the brain and leptomeninges. A subset of individuals with this disorder develop an inflammatory reaction to the amyloid deposition known as cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation, which causes progressive but potentially reversible cognitive decline. However, because cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation is under-recognized, some patients are misdiagnosed with dementia and thus do not receive appropriate treatment. In this episode of NeuroPathways, we're discussing the diagnosis and management of cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation and research aimed at determining its true prevalence and improving clinical care. I'm your host, Glenn Stevens, neurologist, neuro-oncologist in Cleveland Clinic's Neurological Institute, and joining me for today's conversation is Dr. Abbas Kaural. Dr. Kaural is a stroke neurologist in the Cerebrovascular Center in Cleveland Clinic's Neurological Institute. Abbas, welcome to NeuroPathways.
Thank you so much, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Abbas, I know you, but for our audience out there, tell us a little bit about your background, how you made it to the Cleveland Clinic, and what's your specific area of interest.
So, originally from Toronto, Canada, and my interest, particularly later in my medical years, was towards cerebrovascular disorders. And during training, I was always drawn towards cerebrovascular inflammation. So I was really interested in research and kind of solving some of the unanswered questions in cerebral amyloid angiopathy and related disorders. And so to that note, I, after medical school, completed a master's in public health with a major in epidemiology and biostatistics and clinical research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And I stayed in Baltimore for internal medicine training. And then journey of life took me to the Mass General Brigham Harvard Neurology Residency Program, where I completed my neurology residency there, and where I had the pleasure and honor to train with various trainees of Dr. C. Miller Fisher himself, particularly including mentors like Dr. Steven Greenberg, Natalia Ross, and Anish Singhal, who were very formative in my interest in training. And there I developed an interest in particularly cerebral amyloid angiopathy, and I've always been drawn towards the overlap of inflammation and cerebrovascular disorders. So to that note, I completed a fellowship in vascular neurology, followed by a fellowship in autoimmune neurology, and basically wanted to take that training and both the clinical training and the research training to try to help solve or at least shed more light and understand better the disorder of cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation and various other vasculopathies, particularly those that have an inflammatory basis, and cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation is such. So to that note, trying to make my way slowly back to Canada or near Canada, Cleveland Clinic, you know, is an institution very well known for cerebrovascular disorders and inflammation. And this was actually a place where mentors used to say, you know, we want to send you over to Cleveland Clinic to train with those guys and bring it back to Mass General. And then, you know, the journey of life happened and I met great people here, and I thought this would be a great place to serve the patient population here and further my career. And so here we are.
Well, we're happy that you're here. And I'm really glad that you mentioned C. Miller Fisher. He's actually my favorite neurologist. As you know, I'm Canadian as well, so we're having a Canadian love fest here. But I always would tell the residents when I'm on service, read about C. Miller Fisher. And as a stroke vascular neurologist, he's really the father of vascular neurology. And his we obviously don't have time to go through it today, but his history and his life story is just fascinating. And I encourage anybody out there to read about him. It's very fascinating. So I'm looking forward to talking about cerebral. As I'm getting older, I'm more interested in amyloid problems. So I'm looking forward to your talk here about the cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related neuroinflammation. But tell us basically first, what is cerebral amyloid angiopathy?
Absolutely. So to break it up, angiopathy is blood vessel disorder. Cerebral, obviously brain, and amyloid is this protein that abnormally deposits in cortical and leptomeningeal blood vessels and can lead to a very serious hemorrhagic condition, particularly in adults over the age of 50. And it presents as a progressive cause of spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage. And unfortunately, there's no cure to date. And patients with this disorder, we know that have a progressive risk throughout life. As amyloid deposition gets more and more with age, their risk of intracerebral hemorrhage increases. And studies show that, particularly in the aging population, with autopsy studies suggesting that the pathological prevalence ranges anywhere from about 29% in those greater than 50 years of age to about nearly 80% in those particularly octogenarians with Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's is also another amyloid disorder, and that's why there's a lot of overlap and a lot of interest in this disorder, because amyloid, when deposits in cortical and leptomeningeal vessels, causes cerebral amyloid angiopathy. But when it deposits in the brain parenchyma itself, leading to amyloid plaques, that is thought to be the underlying pathology of Alzheimer's disease. And there's a lot of overlap, we believe, and the way we're looking at it is more amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, that there's a spectrum of amyloid-related disorders. On one end of the spectrum is Alzheimer's, and the other end is cerebral amyloid angiopathy. And, you know, the more we're learning about these amyloid disorders, we're learning that there are perhaps similarities in the way amyloid presents. Particularly, we know that one of the subtypes are ApoE alleles of the amyloid. That is what is not only what causes much of the amyloid, but also in Alzheimer's, but also is more prevalent in those with CAA-related inflammation. So CAA itself can present with small microbleeds that can be asymptomatic throughout life, but also can present with macrohemorrhages, which are bigger hemorrhages greater than 5 millimeters, and sometimes a manifestation called cortical superficial siderosis, which is basically on the layers of the brain or the cortical superficial sort of parts of the brain, leading to subarachnoid hemorrhage, which portrays a significantly higher risk of progressive intracerebral hemorrhage throughout life. We do know that, although there's no cure, but the use of anticoagulants and uncontrolled blood pressure particularly can also increase the risk of spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage. Now, a subset of these patients go on to develop a T-cell mediated inflammatory reaction, where we believe it's like your immune system is trying to attack this amyloid in attempt to get rid of it, but it's so complexly intertwined in the blood vessels that not only is it unsuccessful in getting rid of the amyloid, but it causes so much catastrophic damage and inflammation by invasion of macrophages, and basically starts an inflammatory cascade leading to significant cerebral edema. And now this cerebral edema is what causes the progressive cognitive decline, can lead to seizures, headaches. And oftentimes the most surprising part, but also the most devastating part of this, is oftentimes, because it coexists in patients with Alzheimer's disease, so patients with Alzheimer's can often also have concomitant cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which is a slowly progressive process, but CAA-related inflammation, when happens, is more subacute and can lead to much more rapidly progressive cognitive decline. So oftentimes you'll have a patient who has Alzheimer's disease. It's been known for 2, 3, 4 years. It is on this slow decline pathway, but then develops cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which may or may not have been picked up. But then they develop alongside cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation. Now that causes significant decline very quickly, over weeks to months. And oftentimes I've seen, unfortunately, that it goes under-recognized, and the rapidly progressive cognitive decline that happens in these patients is sometimes confused as, oh, this is this patient's dementia that is just terminal and, you know, has just rapidly progressed and this is the end. Whereas as devastating as it can be and can even lead to seizures and sometimes coma, it is still fortunately very treatable and reversible. The inflammation is very reversible and treatable with steroids and other immunosuppressive agents. And so the CAA or I portion is indeed reversible and treatable, and we can get patients back to where they were, back on that slowly progressive track of cognitive decline that they had, sort of, or the natural history of their Alzheimer's. But most importantly, the edema and all that inflammation that's causing the subacute cognitive decline and seizures can be very easily treated within days to weeks.
Now, my understanding, if I remember back to my pathology, is that the vessel walls are weakened related to the amyloid, and that's, they're more friable, right? That's why they bleed. And you can see, as I recall, lobar hemorrhages is more common.
Yes.
And I think I remember the exam question was always Congo red stains.
Yes, amyloid Congo, yeah. The amyloid stain is the positive Congo red stain.
Now, do you see it in other vessels outside of the CNS? So you do an autopsy study, do you see it in the kidneys? Do you see it elsewhere? Is it really localized to the brain?
So the amyloid beta subtype is particularly, we understand, is most localized to the central nervous system, particularly the brain. There haven't been really studies looking at spinal cord extension, but we do know that it's mainly cortical, parenchymal, lobar predominant blood vessels. Now, pathologically, as you were mentioning, yes, it starts off as cerebral microbleeds, but can manifest as larger macrohemorrhages and even subarachnoid hemorrhage. And, you know, oftentimes in conversations with my mentor, Steve Greenberg, he often says, you know, what we don't quite understand is some patients are just microbleeders and they'll just microbleed all their life. They'll have hundreds and thousands of microbleeds and may not go on to develop a macrohemorrhage, whereas some patients will have two microbleeds and the next thing is a big catastrophic macrohemorrhage. We don't clearly understand why that occurs, but we believe it has something to do with the underlying composition of the amyloid.
So if you do a SWI or a gradient sequence on these people that have a lobar hemorrhage, are you most likely probably going to also see susceptibility changes?
Yes,
elsewhere in the brain, they'll have multiple of these because it probably doesn't exist in isolation.
Exactly.
Right?
And rather, when you see an isolated macrohemorrhage in itself, you should think otherwise and want to look into other things like a lobar macrohemorrhage being caused by, a venous sinus thrombosis or underlying vascular malformation, or a tumor or an infarct with hemorrhagic convergence. So those are other things that you want to look at. But normally what really should direct us towards a diagnosis of cerebral amyloid angiopathy as a cause of a macrohemorrhage is, you know, obviously age, greater than 50. They have to meet basically modified Boston criteria for at least possible or probable CAA, which would be evidence of other stigmata, hemorrhagic stigmata, or white matter disease stigmata as well, albeit cerebral microhemorrhages or microbleeds, cortical superficial siderosis, along with the macrohemorrhage, other white matter markers as enlarged perivascular spaces, white matter disease, et cetera.
And the role of hypertension in this, so if you're not hypertensive, is it fairly unlikely you're going to bleed or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. So, you know, the way we're kind of looking at that cerebral amyloid angiopathy as a field is that it is a form of small vessel vasculopathy. And when you have one form of small vessel vasculopathy, you're also likely to have others, but hypertension is not considered a risk factor to our knowledge of cerebral amyloid angiopathy. It's mainly deposition of amyloid.
So you mentioned sort of this T cell response. So is the brain fighting against itself?
It's basically the immune system.
Exactly.
It's an autoimmune phenomenon where the immune system is fighting against the amyloid. But since the amyloid is so complexively intertwined and roped into the blood vessels, it is very difficult for the amyloid to get rid of.
And what percentage of people that have cerebral amyloid will get the inflammatory? I think you mentioned it. But
that's an excellent question. You know, and the right answer to that is we don't know. And that is what our research paper tried to explain is, you know, we talk about cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation as it comes to attention when patients present with, rapid cognitive decline, seizures, headaches, or other signs of edema. And we pick it up on imaging and, you know, we see, oh, behold, this person has either known cerebral amyloid angiopathy before or a new diagnosis and a pattern that fits with edema that is, vasogenic edema or T2 flare hyperintensity in areas of cerebral microbleeds that is much more than what you'd expect from the microbleeds alone. But the true prevalence, I still don't think we understand. So our study tried to look at asymptomatic and symptomatic together. So it was a term that we put out in the literature, a term called radiological cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation, which basically is cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation that radiographically meets criteria for CAARI that may not manifest symptomatically, may not present with the headaches or the cognitive decline or seizures yet, versus the clinical radiographic CAARI, which is clinically manifesting and has radiographic evidence. In our database, or in our study, we showed that CAARI was prevalent about 10.8% of all CAA patients. So we studied about 511 patients with CAA. About 10.8% of those had what we believed at least radiological CAARI, some of which also had clinical radiographic evidence of that as well. But if we looked at specifically the subgroup of CAA with white matter disease of any type, in those patients, the prevalence was as high as 28% who had CAA-related inflammation.
And maybe I'm getting ahead and maybe you don't know the answer, but could you give an immunosuppressant to those patients?
That's another great question, and that's what we're trying to study now in the future, is that what should we be doing with these patients who have radiological CAARI, but do not yet have symptoms from that? Are those patients who we should just monitor radiographically, or are those patients who we should start on treatment? And what are their chances of developing further edema? What are their chances of relapsing and getting worse and manifesting? So those are all questions that we are trying to answer, because right now it is not standard practice to serially image patients with cerebral amyloid angiopathy alone. It is not standard of care or common practice at most centers where you take patients with cerebral amyloid angiopathy who have known CAA at least once or present with a hemorrhage to serially image them, you know, every year or 6 months to see if they are going to develop CAA-related inflammation. Now, as we understand this more, that's another question that, you know, we're trying to answer. And I think a lot of other colleagues and collaborators we're discussing as to how will this change practice? Should we be serially imaging patients with cerebral amyloid angiopathy, at least yearly, maybe? I don't know what the right answer is, to see if they are to go on to develop cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation. And the question is, well, obviously, if they present clinically, of course, we treat them. But if they present with just radiographic sort of isolated inflammation, is that something worth watching? Or should we then start monitoring them once they have radiographic CAARI? I do so in my practice. I've started to serially image patients with cerebral amyloid angiopathy. But I think, you know, we don't have enough data yet to say whether or not that's cost-effective and feasible. And also, should these patients be treated or not? And I think as more studies on CAARI and also sort of allow us to understand better the prevalence of CAARI, maybe we'll be able to know better, as if the prevalence is truly high enough, then maybe we should be serially imaging these patients.
So let's go to the edema. As a vascular neurologist, I'm sure there's lots of vascular neurologists out there salivating when they look at someone that has a stroke and you see edema and you go, boy, steroids should help this, but it doesn't, because it's cytotoxic edema. So the edema here must be vasogenic edema.
It is vasogenic.
Is that right?
Absolutely, yes, vasogenic edema.
Secondly, what percentage of patients do you have to go in and do something surgically with the hemorrhage? Or is that uncommon with these types of bleeds?
So again, depends on particularly what type of hemorrhage they have. So we do know that most patients will have just progressive cerebral microbleeds. A small percentage of them may go on to have a larger macrohemorrhage. We do know that the progressive risk of recurrent macrohemorrhage is about 10% based on studies from Mass General, from Dr. Greenberg and Adib Goral's work, and Dr. Chardimon's work as well. But as far as surgical evacuation for macrohemorrhage, so we do know from previous data from Stitch trial that was not sort of standard of practice. It did not improve functional outcomes. However, the recent enriched trial with minimally invasive surgery did show that there was benefit of minimally invasive surgery in patients with lobar macrohemorrhages who had basically signs of clinical radiographic deterioration It was an adaptive design trial, and basically during the trial showed that lobar hemorrhages benefited, basal ganglia hemorrhages or deep hemorrhages did not. And so based on adaptive design, they excluded patients with deeper hemorrhages. You know, that has certainly changed practice. We are now taking patients who progress with neurologic deterioration with macrohemorrhages who meet criteria of enriched trial for evacuation. And there are talks about further expanding that or doing a sub-study of enriched for basal ganglia hemorrhages as well. But cerebral amyloid angiopathy for purposes of CAA, we know that that's a lobar predominant. So yes, if you have patients who have large macrohemorrhages with neurologic deterioration who meet criteria per enrich, I think with the data that we have now, at least minimally invasive surgery for evacuation will be a topic of discussion for those patients.
So let's say I'm your patient. And I have some history of cerebral amyloid, and I've had a decline. So go through a few things with me. One, let's say you scan me and you see some edema and you decide I should have a lumbar puncture done. What's the likelihood the spinal tap is going to be abnormal with this inflammatory process? Is it inflammatory or non-inflammatory?
First of all, I never wish to have that. But the most important thing is recognizing the entity of cerebral amyloid angiopathy related inflammation and how it's a very treatable entity if picked up earlier and treated appropriately. So if a patient with known cerebral amyloid angiopathy or even a patient with Alzheimer's disease who could have concomitant CAA, if that patient presents with, say, a seizure or rapid cognitive decline or headaches, that is a patient who I want to image. At least, if you don't have an MRI available, getting at least a CT brain to look for the possibility of ischemic edema. But then obviously an MRI brain, because CARI is a clinical radiographic diagnosis. You do not need CSF to make the diagnosis for that. And that is, again, from data from mentors at Mass General who've shown that it's more of a clinical radiographic diagnosis. Now, we do know that the pathogenesis involves anti-amyloid antibodies. And so there are patients who oftentimes I will go on to do CSF, particularly those patients who I'm concerned who may have amyloid beta-related angiitis, which is more of a transmural CNS vasculitis caused by amyloid and is the much more aggressive sort of vasculitic form. Caused by amyloid. But if we were to do CSF studies in these patients, we often see some CSF inflammation, and that's usually some elevated CSF protein. We don't often see CSF pleocytosis because it's not an infective process. But even by way of, since it's more sort of perivascular inflammation, you may see some elevated protein. And if any cells, a few cells with lymphocytic pleocytosis, but mainly CSF protein elevation, which is nonspecific, oftentimes you'll see normal CSF completely. The testing of anti-amyloid antibodies in CSF is not commercially available. Dr. Piazza in Milan is a scientist who has been doing that in his lab under research and is a collaborator on that. But this is not something that's commercially readily available. So when the diagnosis is in question, that is when I do perform CSF analysis on these patients. Recently, I had a patient who presented with cognitive decline, not so much so progressive rapid, but a very kind of subacute to late cognitive decline, and I was worried about concomitant Alzheimer's in that patient. So I did pursue CSF in that patient, particularly also not just to look at their CSF profile, but also to look at amyloid and tau markers. And behold, it did show that they met the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And so yes, if you're gathering other information or you really are questioning the diagnosis to rule out an infectious or other inflammatory process, I think it's reasonable. But is it necessary to make a diagnosis? Not necessarily.
If you feel that I need to go on some steroids, what's your steroid of choice? IV or oral?
So initially, you know, I've approached this on, and I think I've learned a lot over the years on how to treat cerebral amyloid angiopathy related inflammation. And I still think that, you know, our regimen is not perfect. We can always improve. But if the patients are inpatient, if they present inpatient, particularly if they're, you know, presenting with seizures or in status epilepticus or comatose, those are patients who, since we're able to, we'll start them on IV methylprednisolone, a gram daily for 5 days, followed by a prednisone, long prednisone taper.
How long do people need to be on steroids? Is this a week thing? Is this a month thing? Is this
no, normally thing? It's a few months. So the inflammation starts to reverse in about a few weeks. But I normally keep these patients on about 3 to 4 months of prednisone on a slow taper, starting at about 1 mg/kg, roughly about 60 to 80 milligrams, and then tapering by about 5 milligrams every other week, and then serially imaging these patients. In the outpatient setting, however, kind of from what we learned from the optic neuritis trials, that, you know, IV steroids may give you a head start, but at the end of the race, both oral prednisone and IV prednisone, or those who got IV plus oral kind of at the end, ultimately did the same. And that's what I've seen in my practice, that the inflammation kind of gets better regardless with steroids, IV or oral. IV might work a little quicker, but ultimately, as you treat them, even in the outpatient setting with just oral prednisone alone, they will start to get better. I think there are several unanswered questions, and these are questions that have come in my mind as I have treated these patients, and particularly, I think we have one of the largest CARI population here at the Cleveland Clinic that I've been able to sort of gather over the past few years. Now, the questions in my mind were always, well, how long do these people really need to be on steroids for? And not only that, previous literature kind of had shown that about 1/3 of these patients will relapse once steroids are stopped and need things like mycophenolate or cyclophosphamide.
Do you guys use Rituxan? It seems like Rituxan is being used for everything.
Yeah. Given that it's more of a T-cell mediated response, not so much rituximab, but more T-cell directed therapies. So the question in my mind was, one, what truly is the percentage of patients who do relapse? And why do those relapse, right? Are there predictors that can help us predict who's going to relapse and who's not? And so that's kind of a small prospective study that we did. And what our study showed was I tried to look at imaging predictors. Can I pick up on MRI up front, on a first MRI of a patient? Can I predict if this person has a high chance of relapse or not? And maybe those are the patients who I want to up front have that conversation of steroid sparing therapy, particularly mycophenolate with those patients. So our data did show that those who relapse were more likely to relapse if they had on imaging either a diffuse pattern of edema had also temporal lobe involvement. And temporal lobe involvement patients are the ones who are going to seize more. Those are the patients who often present in status epilepticus. So those patients, particularly with a diffuse pattern of edema, are the ones who are going to relapse. And the time to relapse in our data was at a median of about 5.5 months after their steroids were stopped. So we'll treat them with steroids for about 4 months on a slow taper, but once their steroids are stopped, those who had a diffuse pattern of edema relapsed at about a median of about 5.5 months. And rather than me waiting to see these patients relapse and then have a conversation about mycophenolate, my practice has changed to when I see a diffuse pattern of edema on imaging, that's a patient who upfront I will have a conversation that based on our study, there was a tenfold higher risk of relapse if you had a diffuse pattern of edema. So I tell them that, you know, based on our data, although, you know, it's a small patient population, it's still probably the largest study that has been done so far looking at imaging predictors of relapse in this patient population. So those are the patients who I will start on mycophenolate upfront along with the prednisone. And so we taper them as we ramp down the prednisone, we ramp up the Celecept, and then ultimately they're on mycophenolate. And then the other thing I will say is a bit different. I think that has been really one of the benefits of being a cerebrovascular neurologist and immunologist as well. I mean, I've learned so much from, even in my training, from colleagues in rheumatology who treat a much younger patient population, right? That patient with psoriasis who comes in at the age of 25 or 30, they can probably tolerate or take a lot more immunosuppression. But I've realized along the initial years of my career that these patients that I'm treating are 70, 80 years old, more prevalent in females than men. And so, you know, these 80-year-old females with cerebral amyloid angiopathy-related inflammation, who I'm putting on immunosuppression, you know, may not be the strongest substrate to tolerate 3 grams of mycophenolate or, you know, a lot of cyclophosphamide, for example. So I tend to use an approach where I ramp up their mycophenolate a lot slower and try to use the lowest dose of immunosuppression that gets the job done, and then serially follow and image these patients at about 3 to 6 month intervals. And as long as we've established remission, then continuing them on immunosuppression. And I think the question that still remains is, how long should we treat these patients with immunosuppression? Are they going to stay on it for the rest of their lives? if we look at sort of what we've learned from the MS field, that, you know, early aggressive treatment and most often lifelong is probably the way to go. But I think those are still several questions we have.
Well, Awas, I appreciate your being here today. It's very informative. I always learn things, and I know our audience does as well, and appreciate your being here today.
It has been my utmost pleasure, and you know, I always enjoy our conversations.
This concludes this episode of NeuroPathways. You can find additional podcast episodes on our website, clevelandclinic.org/neuropodcast, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, you can access real-time updates from experts in Cleveland Clinic's Neurological Institute on our Consult QD website. That's consultqd.clevelandclinic.org/neuro, or follow us on Twitter at CLE Clinic MD, all one word. And thank you for listening.